From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Carl Morgenstern is the Watershed Restoration Program Manager for the Eugene Water and Electric Board, known as EWEB. He's currently in the role of Watershed Recovery Task Force Leader under Lane County Emergency Operations responding to the Holiday Farm Fire of September 2020. Thank you, Carl. I appreciate you being here on the Oregon Grapevine for giving us your time and expertise. So thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Holiday Farm Fire, which of course took place up the Mackenzie River east of Eugene and Springfield, was devastating. And many of us are rather shocked when we drive up the highway, and I'm sure you're one of them, and see the differences that that fire has made in just the topography and the view. And I'm wondering, is the damage as bad as it looks, or can it be restored?
I think it'd be restored. I think, in fact, it could be, in a way, restored back better than it was before in the long term. But in the short term, yes, it's significant impacts, and it's not a pretty sight. It's devastation, and it's tear-jerking to look at and remember what used to be.
Let's go to your comment that you think it could maybe be better. Let's start there. How?
Well, first off, as we rebuild, we're able to rebuild in ways that are more up to date and use different ways of building. Some of those homes are from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and in addition to that, we're offering landowners incentives for rebuilding where they could basically get up to $7,000 to move their house back from the river and rebuild in a different location out of the floodway or the floodplain and riparian area. So our hope is that some landowners take advantage of that opportunity to rebuild out of a hazard zone. And then the other is that as we rebuild, we can upgrade septic systems and do things like that, as well as maybe get some of those homes that people don't want to rebuild in the floodway out of the floodway through acquisitions if they don't want to, if they don't want to go through the process of rebuilding and they just want to sell. We have the opportunity to acquire some of those critical areas that from willing landowners that just want to move on but yet give back to the river by turning their property into conservation. Those are a few things.
Can we talk a little about logistics? Because I really don't know anything about how you would reclaim the ownership, or let's say someone doesn't want to rebuild there. Or you talked about maybe acquiring them or et cetera. Who does that? EWEB does that? We do that? Mackenzie Trust does that?
Yeah, the way we're EWEB's board approved a watershed recovery and restoration package in March that included $3.9 million. To do risk-based work, which is kind of getting, working with septic systems, revegetation, doing erosion control, those kinds of things, as well as monitoring the water quality. And then the other big chunk of that is kind of a resiliency investment, and that's where we look at removing or acquiring property in partnership with the Mackenzie River Trust, where essentially we put our money in and Mackenzie River Trust matches it 50-50. And then if there's a willing landowner, the trust can purchase that land and put it into conservation.
Burned in that fire were not just trees, of course. There were cars, structures, etc. And I know that some of that material that burned is not really meant to be burning, like insulation in a house, for instance. And it ends up in the ground. It might end up in the water. I know water is kind of your specialty. So how do you get rid of house insulation, or how do you get rid of the plastics or the aluminum in an automobile and make both the land safe for growing, let's say, an organic garden and or the water to drink?
Yeah, well, it's been, since the fire occurred, and as you point out, a lot of different items and structures and cars and boats basically were destroyed and burned to where, a two-story house was essentially a pile of ash. And so all that debris or all that insulation and furniture and siding and roof material all basically got incinerated. And so when we initially responded to the fire, basically we identified those high-priority homes that are right on the river for stabilization, basically to stabilize that ash and debris from flowing into the river until it could be removed. And that's kind of where the phase of cleanup is now with ODOT coming in with their contractors to essentially scrape the ash off and then debris and take it to Short Mountain Landfill and then remove the foundations and that kind of thing. So all that wood, debris, and ash is basically being being cleaned up right now as we speak. And so our role early on was trying to put any stabilization, erosion control, you know, what we call silt fence and wattles, to prevent that ash from washing into the river during the rainstorms of the winter until ODOT could come in and clean it up.
I understand, and I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here, but I understand that, of course, you stabilize as much as you can and you get it out and you get rid of it, but not all of it. Some of it had already dispersed by the time you all or other authorities came in there. So some of it is certainly in someone's organic garden, or it's around, there's plastic right. insulation floating around. You know, is that just one of the hazards of living in a culture and there it is?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You know, we focused on this, the areas of the homes that were right on the river, right on creeks that had the most highest priority for that kind of, for rushing into the river. But the other piece is obviously you have that ash and that smoke, you know, basically depositing across the whole area. And so one of the things we did early on was essentially, and we've been still doing, is doing storm event water quality monitoring. And so right after the storm event, when we had all that ash fall, we looked at the initial rain events that washed the ash off of essentially the streets of Springfield and put it into the stormwater system. So we were monitoring Springfield stormwater system to see kind of what that impact from that ash was. And we were sampling for, you know, combustible materials, you know, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, PFAS, and organics. And really, you know, we found a few things, a few polyaromatic hydrocarbons in low levels and some volatile organics like benzene. But all in all, you know, once it hit the river, it's pretty much diluted out. So we're not seeing that at our intake. But regardless, you're right in that, you know, there is going to be, you know, that material that's deposited across this area. And that, you know, there's not a whole lot we can do about that except for continue monitoring and respond to areas that we see that there might be a problem.
What can residents do about that? Let's say that I'm concerned about benzene. I've been reading about it, for instance, or I know it's out there. I know I'm not supposed to be drinking microplastics, even though they're all over the place. What do I, as a resident, do? Obviously, I understand that EWEB and hope that EWEB is making my water drinkable. I assume it. But what do I do if I'm a little more concerned? Do you have thoughts about that?
You could always put a filtration on your, you know, your faucet system, or, you know, use a, like a Brita filter or something like that, if you're concerned about that. Our treatment process does effectively, I mean, the water coming out of our treatment plant is the same quality as the water pre-fire. We have not seen any impacts. We had a little bit of taste and odor issues early on after the fire, but that was because of, you know, some other things that happened in the watershed, not really related to the fire. So anyway, not to get down that rabbit hole, but yeah, so... There are things you could do in the household to add another layer of filtration if you're concerned.
Let's go down one rabbit hole for just a moment, which is that are there new substances that maybe haven't been historically found? Maybe it's because of the fire. Maybe it's because of other reasons. Are there new things kind of popping up that you all test for? Are you testing for them? Are you finding them?
Well, we are testing for about everything we can think of to test for. And, you know, like I said, early on during the early phase of the fire, we were seeing, you know, a few organics that we had not seen previously in the stormwater channels and creeks. But since then, basically, we have not seen organics since the early, you know, the ash fall and the runoff of the ash. And what we have been seeing is, you know, kind of some elevated levels of, like, nutrients and metals, organic carbon. And basically what that is happening is during a storm, which, you know, we haven't had a lot of those, we see those elevated levels. And after the storm goes by, the base flow essentially goes back to pre-fire quality. So it's really these small flushing events that we see a little bit of an increase in nutrients and metals and organic carbon. But then after the storm, it goes back to kind of pre-fire quality, water quality standard.
river quality anyway.
Can you speak to the river itself, not necessarily the filtered water that we're drinking or the treated water that we're drinking and that we know is okay, but there was talk when the fire happened specifically about the recreational uses of the river and that the topography of that river, if that is the proper word, has changed. The people who used to really know it well in terms of drifting down or floating down, it's a very different landscape. There are other things in that water. Can you speak, not necessarily to the, you know, maybe don't be drinking directly out of the river piece, but the recreational use of the river? Are there things people should think about?
Well, yeah, I think the river has changed fairly significantly in some ways as far as having more hazards on the river now, as far as, down trees and wood and build up of wood in certain areas that it used to not be. You know, if you're used to going river left on a certain area, maybe you need to go river right. Also, the boat ramps are pretty much, most of them are closed right now. So the river, yeah, is very different than it was pre-fire. And one of the things that we built early going into the winter was kind of a shared hazard system where river guides could essentially, with their phone, enter a hazard that then would be part of, you know, so all the agencies and the Marine Board could all see these hazards and report them to, you know, to boaters. So we are trying to get a system in place that kind of helps map where the hazards are based on people that are on the river. You know, it's just it's a different feel, different environment. I mean, there's lack of vegetation, obviously.
Do you have either thoughts or specific information or suggestions of how this cannot happen again? Not necessarily that damages a lot of that damage. A lot of those places are not going to burn again because they have already burned. But what do we do as a culture? What do we do as a individual people or larger groups to prevent this kind of disaster from happening again?
Well, I think there's a couple things there. One, obviously, is that given we are in a new world of climate change and uncertainty associated with that, that we're going to have more extreme events, we're going to have droughts, we're going to have wildfires, we're going to have floods, and they're going to happen in magnitudes that we probably haven't seen before, just like last fire season. So being prepared for essentially and being resilient to those kind of large-scale impacts that we can't really plan for because we haven't seen the likes of them for hundreds, you know, like this fire that happened. They think, you know, maybe 100 years ago that the Potomac fire was comparable. But so there's that kind of that new world that we're in, and so that's kind of we need to kind of pay attention to and as individuals adapt to. And I think as individuals living in these environments like the McKenzie Watershed, there are things we can do. And we're actually working with the University of Oregon Landscape Architecture Department to a studio class of grad students that has helped us kind of start designing a naturescaping, essentially the landscaping you put around your house after you rebuild or even if you weren't impacted by the fire, but changing your landscape to be more natives, creating a buffer between the house and the river, but also doing it with a fire-wise approach. And so you can, you know, and there are many examples when upriver where, you know, a fire did not impact a house. A large part of that is because the house was such that it had that the lack of vegetation that knocked the fire down before it hit the house. That wasn't always true, but a lot of cases we saw that. So there is a way that you could do landscaping and position your home to where you're not going to be impacted by a fire, or you're more resilient to fire. And I think the same thing could be said for where you position your house when you rebuild it. If you're rebuilding in a floodway or a floodplain or riparian area, we are going to probably have floods that we haven't seen before because the lack of vegetation. If we do get big storms, most of it's going to run off now. And so putting yourself in those hazard zones really is not a good idea. But, you know, people do it, and it is what it is.
And really, the last concern that I want to ask about is logging. There are concerns that what is taking place along the river, a lot of trees are being cut down. Obviously, I'm sure some of those, maybe all those trees need to be cut down, but that's not what I'm hearing. Do you have reactions to the quickness and the overwhelming amount of trees that are coming down along the river?
Yeah, it's a heartbreak. Yeah, as far as the amount of trees, hazard trees being removed, there's and salvage logging. I mean, there's obviously two things happening. One is hazard trees being removed along Highway 126 and county roads and people's property, so that it's safe for them to come back in and contractors to do work in those areas. And then there's the salvage logging, which obviously timber companies are trying. They're against a clock to try and get as much wood out of the forest as they can before disease and rot set in, and that wood loses value. Yeah, there's a lot of logging, and it is going to have an impact. I think a couple of impacts are obviously, there's going to be potentially more sediment over a longer period of time in the river. But the other piece that we're concerned about is, especially on the industrial timberlands, that if you're essentially cutting all that whole middle part of the watershed and replanting, you're now putting that whole area, tens of thousands of acres, in the same rotation. Whereas before, they would have harvests, 46, 80 acre harvests, but the rotation was all staggered. Now everything is on the same time scale for harvest in 40 years, say. And as well, there's going to be a lot more herbicide use to help the seedlings survive in those first 3 years, and it will be across a large part of the watershed. So, yes, we are concerned about that. We're monitoring for that. And the other piece that we're doing is, as part of our resilience effort, is really doing large-scale floodplain restoration projects that in these creek basins and in the river itself, downstream of these large landscape burned areas. And what we mean by that is, right now, when you look at these creeks or the river itself, like the South Fork, it's an incised channel because of roads and other things that happened. And basically what we're doing is then going in and looking at reattaching that creek to its floodplain. So it spreads out its flow, it drops out sediment, it attenuates metals and nutrients and organic carbon, and mitigates for floods. And so by doing that, we also feel like we would be mitigating impacts, other impacts coming off those landscapes that could be, say, from herbicides. Clearly, as EWEB, we're not someone that is into making new laws or regulations for others to follow. We are a entity that works with folks voluntarily in the watershed to do conservation and increase, the health of the watershed. And so we want to work with people, basically.
Do you have advice? Let's jump back for a second about what you said about cutting the logs or cutting the trees and being on similar rotation and herbicides being sprayed or applied. And I understand that you as EWEB aren't necessarily the ones who are going to go in there and have the oversight and say you can or cannot do that. But do you have advice, let's say, for people who are living up the river or who are using the river or those of us who just simply, as it were, drink the water that's coming down from there? Is there oversight? Is there something that potentially people can do?
Well, the oversight we have that we're doing is, a lot of storm event and non-storm event pesticide monitoring to see what levels are coming off the landscape. And we have not seen pesticide levels in the water. I mean, we have not detected pesticides, and we're still waiting for a storm, obviously, this spring, which we hope it eventually comes, to sample after, more spraying has happened. Our approach is, well, let's monitor the situation, and if we see something, then we bring in, DEQ, ODF, bring folks together, say, look, we're starting to see some things. What can we do to change the trajectory? But I don't, the levels, until we see levels in the river, I mean, we've been monitoring the river since 2001, and have maybe had 8 detections of a pesticide in the river at trace levels below what instruments can actually read in the lab. So they're estimated values, because lab can't actually quantify it. And so we just haven't seen, McKinsey's an incredibly clean system because it is a massive spring-fed system. And so, hate to say it, but that clear, clean, pure water coming out of the springs is diluting out other things that wash into it as it flows downstream. And so, our instruments can only detect down to, parts per quadrillion. And so there's probably stuff in the river, but it's such low concentrations that we can't actually see it. So I'm not sure what advice would be needed, I guess.
Right. Although it sounds like what you are doing is if there was a problem, you would find it after the fact as opposed to preventing it before it happened, which isn't your job. I'm not saying that is something eWeb should or should not be doing, but it isn't something that eWeb does. eWeb checks afterwards to make sure the water is safe as opposed to perhaps other organizations that may or may not want to be involved with saying, don't do it to begin with.
Well, that's partially true, I think, because what we do is because we check so often that it's not like, at least I haven't seen this in my career, that it's like a light switch where one day the water's clean, next day it's there's too much contaminants in it to drink. I mean, that's what you usually see is a slow or a trend that's heading in one direction. And so our efforts are to pick up on that trend before it becomes a problem and then once we get information that says, hey, the trend is not looking good, we're seeing it moving in this direction, let's start working with folks to reverse that trend. I think it's really hard to try to work with folks when we don't have a problem, so to speak, with the water quality. So it's hard to say, hey, the sky is falling, we need to jump on this and do something before we actually can show that there's a problem. So I don't know how else to respond to that.
No, that's great. I appreciate it. It sounds like what we need to hope for is, in fact, water falling so that we can get some storm testing. And is there something else you want to add here about just what people should know about the water and the safety of it?
Well, no, I think, one of the things that we strive to do and I think do it really well in the McKinsey is we work together with a lot of different people, not only landowners, but agencies and organizations. And so there's we have a collaborative that we built years ago before the fire called the Pure Water Partners. And since the fire, we basically used that partnership and that infrastructure to pivot to respond to the fire. But we're working with hundreds of landowners up there doing various activities from revegetation and erosion control and invasive weed surveys and response so we can hit invasives before they become a problem. I just think the level of cooperation and coordination, at least in the McKinsey, is such that, we feel pretty good that, we have an impact, we have a problem, but, there could be some positive that comes out of this. I guess that's the note I want to leave it on, that, the future isn't bleak. It does look like we can come out of this better than maybe we went into it.
Thank you. Thank you for leaving it on a positive note. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.